From Unreal Films, documentary filmmaker Tony Sartorius joins us. Tony, good morning to you, sir.
G'day, mate. How are you doing?
Yeah, doing all right. It's been 3.5 years since we last spoke in this capacity. August Holy of 2019. Moly. How do you feel about that? Do you feel okay about that?
That's fine. Kind of normal for the gestation of my films, apparently, which is a bit concerning, but there you go. You know, that's probably realistic.
Here are the babies. The last time we got together, this is 3.5 years ago. There we are. Look, the two of us, just babies.
You're a lot wiser in beard length, mate.
Yeah. And funnily enough, the colors change somehow. I don't know how that happens as you get older. We'll talk about that. Not entirely sure.
It's this bloody horrible summer we've been having, I think.
So, yeah, so this is the last time we talked, just as a little addendum, a little side note there.
Yeah.
And that was 3.5 years ago, and it was because you just released Helen Kelly Together, feature film documentary. And I actually had to listen back to that podcast.
Oh, cool.
I don't know why. It was more like I wasn't trying to do research, but I thought I started playing it, and I'm like, oh. And it was really interesting because it was August 2019. Otherwise known as pre-pandemic.
Yeah, the before and times.
We were talking about that documentary you made, and you're here today to talk about your new documentary, Elements of Truth. And that was a documentary, and we were having conversations in that podcast about how you're going to put this documentary out. Is it going to go to Netflix? Is it going to go on TV? Is it on the big screen? And I feel like we're going to get into that conversation about this documentary as well, because it's a very different delivery system.
But get me started, Pat. I warn you now.
The thing that was interesting at the start of that conversation, we were talking about, have you heard these rumors about TVNZ and RNZ merger and maybe bringing Māori TV in, and TV3 is almost bankrupt? And so that was the conversation we were having back then. And just in the last couple of weeks, of course, we've finally heard, in my personal opinion, due to the fear of not getting elected, the Labor government saying no to the merger. But I thought it might be nice to kind of come full circle, and people can go and find that podcast online if they want to have a listen to it, about what's happening in the media cycle right now, the delivery system right now, and how you decided to go with a digital delivery system on spin-off with this documentary, as opposed to big screen, as opposed to TV, as opposed to streaming. Do you want to tell us that story?
Sure. I mean, there's probably different ways of telling the story, you know, but what it really comes down to is that there's a really serious problem emerging, which I haven't actually heard discussed very much.
Right.
Which is that, particularly for my type of thing, you know, documentaries about New Zealand that are for a New Zealand audience, our ability to actually connect with that audience is in a, well, to be slightly hyperbolic, it's in a state of collapse, and it's getting worse steadily. I mean, you know, everybody knows about Netflix and so forth. Everybody's probably heard that the audiences for broadcast television are falling like a rock, especially for younger viewers. And what that means in practice is that if New Zealand audiences want to connect to high quality international product, and why not, then their choices have never been better. And, you know, there's awesome things in all of our living rooms, which I'm certainly enjoying. I bet everyone is. Problem is that if you actually want to make content, and if you want to see content which is specifically about New Zealand, specifically for a New Zealand audience, the mechanisms that deliver that are just disappearing, you know, almost before our eyes, and to an extraordinary extent, way faster than I think most people expected. And there really, as far as I can see, there isn't any response to that which seems anywhere near muscular enough to actually meaningfully address it. You know, films like What I Make, basically traditionally have had two ways of reaching an audience. We can do it in cinemas, which has been good because it's been kind of culturally valued, so you get reviews and you get taken seriously and all that kind of thing. Yeah. And maybe then, or instead, you could go to broadcast television. Both of those are in a pretty bad way, especially TV, but actually cinema's not too good either. The number of people, probably because there's such a, you know, such an influx of high quality international stuff that you can watch now, to actually get people to pay money to go to the cinema to watch a documentary is sort of an increasingly narrower proposition, and the audiences are noticeably changing. I could actually see it when we were on the road showing Helen Kelly together. Mm-hmm. You know, the audiences were varied to a degree, but overwhelmingly they consisted of older women, older like as in retirement age women.
Could that have been also to do with Helen Kelly, though, their connection to Helen Kelly, like seeing her in their stories?
That's actually kind of what I thought at the time, but it turns out that that's reflected in documentary attendance generally. And in fact, if you now go to the documentary distributors, the first question they ask is, will this film appeal to older women? Because those are the people, the Pākehā women, because those are the people who pay regularly to go and see a documentary at the cinema. I guess because they're just in the habit of going every week and they go to whatever's on, you know. But that whole model of watching films is really, really dropped. And so those two things kind of both in strife. There isn't anything else. You know, you can make films for an international audience. Well, you'll try to. And, you know, a lot of New Zealand filmmakers have had good success with that, and it's exciting, and the industry's kind of full of beans about it because suddenly we can talk to everyone everywhere. But if you go to Netflix, as we did, in fact, with this most recent film, and say to them, hey, here's this film we're making, their first question, I guess reasonably, is, well, will people in Iowa understand it? Or care about it? And if they won't, then it's not for them. And so therefore, we actually don't have a way to talk to our New Zealand audiences now.
So Netflix does do like a geo-specific content, though. Like, because we get stand-up comedies on Netflix that are Kiwi artists and stuff, but I guess funny is still funny, and even if they don't get the cultural reference to a Kiwi stand-up, they'll still get the funny. And I was also thinking there seems to be a lot of Bollywood, but then again, that's a localized market of a billion people, so that's probably easier to pitch to a localized market. But this latest documentary is very niche, because it's kind of niche within niche within niche of politics. It's drilling right down into less than 1% vote. I don't mean the themes around it. I mean the subject matter of it.
I mean, look, I think there's an interesting question about what actually is an international story, because, you know, like I went to AIDC the Australian International Documentary Conference, and everybody is all about making international product, but no one's really able to describe exactly what that means, because a lot of the products that succeed really well internationally seem super niche. You know, Making a Murderer, for example, it's not got to do with anyone, but people everywhere want to see it, right? So I think in theory, you know, very specific New Zealand content could cross over and become international, but in reality, it doesn't really work. Like, you kind of need to have a bit of an interest in New Zealand culture specifically. For example, you know, issues around Billy Tike and this whole movement are pretty entwined with Maori issues and post-colonialism. And, you know, really international broadcasters they're not that interested in that. You know, that's a New Zealand thing. I mean it isn't just a New Zealand thing, but it's seen as being something that only we would be interested in. So they were sort of kind of interested, but the questions were like, oh, you know, we'll need to get a story produced, we'll have to explain everything, you know, da-di-da-di-da. And it was turning into something that wasn't worth making, in my opinion. So we didn't go that way.
I don't mean to be flippant with this question, but Helen Kelly's Together, for people who haven't seen it, is about the last 12 months of Helen Kelly's life. Jamie Lee Ross was sort of about the death of his political career. I mean, is there something that you're drawn to the things coming to an end? I mean, I'm not meaning to be flippant. I don't want to paint Helen Kelly's serious story in the same sort of light, but you know, both of them have an element of coming to an obvious and final end. Is there any kind of theme that you're drawn to something like that?
I mean, in the case of Helen, it was, I suppose, pretty obvious that that's how the film would end. But I mean, it wasn't as obvious with Jamie Lee Ross and that movement. You know, it just turned out to be that way. I'm interested. I suppose what I really look for in documentaries and what I really respond to is situations where it feels like something specific is happening, but it means something bigger. I think that gives them a timelessness, and it means that when they are finally made and out there, perhaps what they seem to mean at the time has matured, and so therefore people are ready to reflect in a slightly more thoughtful way on what they really meant. I think Jamie Lee Ross, I mean, Helen's a great example of that, but Jamie Lee Ross is not a bad example either, because people maybe wouldn't have been willing to sit down and think about it for 20 minutes at the time. But now I think, you know, it feels a little bit far away and slightly safely historic, so people are perhaps willing to look under the covers a wee bit and into what it actually means.
Yeah.
Documentaries are only kind of about what they're about, if they're any good. I think they're really about, you know, the deeper eddies and currents and culture and society. That's where they should be fishing.
I was going to play you a little clip from the last time we chatted. So this is on Spotify. This is the podcast in question. You talk about in this podcast what you think about politics, and I'll play it for you. It's only like a 10-second, 15-second clip. Yeah, yeah. So let's have a listen to what you think about politics.
Well, you know, something that I find sad about New Zealand politics, a change that seems to have happened, is that we seem to be quite willing to kind of, you know, join a team and think that that's what it's all about.
Mm.
You know, when actually I don't think that's even Helen. I don't think she quite saw it like that. I think she thought it was about the merits of the argument.
I agree. I think that's absolutely what it's about.
Yeah.
So in that time, you were talking about what politics was to you. And about joining a team is what it seems to be, tribalism, I guess I could paraphrase that as. But what it should be is about, you know, the merits of the argument. How does that relate into this new podcast to do with your decision to approach Jamie Lee Ross about doing sort of a fly on the wall documentary about him? Where are the, what were you saying then, and how does it relate to today with what the work you've just done, what you've just released?
What I was particularly drawn to actually in the first case wasn't Jamie Lee Ross specifically, it was the movement that he had attached himself to and the sort of explosive appearance of Billy TK and yeah, the obviously quite large and quite passionate support that was attracting. I found that surprising and to be honest, to be really, really honest, I found it sort of irritating. It pissed me off. And I think a lot of people probably felt that, even if they didn't quite name it that way. And I was interested in that. You know, I lost family members to, you know, what I will disrespectfully call the rabbit hole. And I was mad about it. I was personally kind of, I wanted to understand what the hell was going on. And what.
Hang on, so to be clear, you're talking about the anti-mandate, anti-vax, anti-mask sort of government's trying to control us. China's bought into us. WEF is controlling the world. That's sort of the encompassing world you're talking about losing people into?
Yes. And you know, it's worth noting that at the time that I shot this film, a lot of that hadn't really taken shape yet. You know, vaccines didn't exist yet. And it was before the before times, but the music of that was being heard, like, and you could sort of, you could sense that it was heading in that general direction.
Right, right.
But also some of the deeper foundational belief structures that Billy TK were talking about then, perhaps a little bit more nakedly, were you know, they're clearer and weirder in many ways. And I mean, they seem to me to speak of a sort of an alienation and just a really deep rejection of the fundamental goodwill of our society that it troubled me and I found it interesting. So I just really wanted to understand it and to try to be able to explain it somehow.
I would like to talk to you in some specifics about the documentary. And the last time we had Joanna, we talked about Helen Kelly. It was a release on the cinema, and we didn't want to stop people from going to buy a ticket and getting in. This is really different. It's a 22 minutes. Yep. It's online. I've been watching it on YouTube. I'm assuming it's actually embedded into Spinoff as well, which is your partner in this.
Yep.
And I want to talk a bit more openly about two or three instances in there, because there's no barrier of entry now of buying a ticket. So I'm not so worried about spoilers. I guess is what I'm trying to say this time around. But just tell me.
Actually, by the way, it is. If anyone wants to see it, it is. It's on YouTube. It's free. You can see it anywhere in the world. And, you know, go if you like.
Before we do that, though, I'd like to be interested as to how you got into this. Is it Hex Productions or Hex Works? Duncan Greaves sort of, I guess, side company for making product for Spinoff. So is this an Unreal Films production? Has Hex employed you to do this? What's the relationship between you directing this, you owning this, and their production of this? How does that all work?
Well, it was kind of a, you know, like many films are, it was a bit of a lumpy story. Basically, in the beginning, I approached Duncan to discuss some kind of co-production idea, because it seemed to me that the spin-off had access to an audience that almost no one else seemed to, which was basically young, political Auckland, you know, just an interesting crowd. And I thought they'd be interested and should be interested in this material. And I thought I could make the film. I thought I could get the access. They were pretty skeptical about that, but I did get the access. And one thing led to another. The original plan was to make a feature. I've shot a feature, and the feature's much broader in its range. The film that we've made, the reason we've made it at this length and in this form is simply because this is what works on Facebook and YouTube, based on, you know, all of their hard numbers and so forth. And I'm desperate. Is that the right word? I'm very keen to try to invest some effort into finding a new way to reach the audience for the reasons I've described before. I would love to go and make the feature film. You know, 80% of the material I shot wasn't even included in our edit consideration for this particular project. Wow. The rest deals more with the followers and Billy TK himself, and kind of like the general social dynamics that were driving.
I want to see that documentary, Tony.
I want to make it. Yeah, let's make
it. I want to see that.
Yeah, I'd love to. We have been unsuccessful in persuading the Film Commission that that's something that they would like to support, and there isn't really another way to make it or distribute it. So that, at the moment, is in a state of limbo. But we haven't given up trying.
And, have you spent any time on it, though? Like, have you got a rough edit of a 90-minute doco, or is it just got the footage and you know you've got a plan to do it?
We've spent a bit of time on it in the sense of preparatory editing. It's probably about a month's editing in addition to what you see. And it's... yeah, I mean, I think it has the potential to be the most important film I've made, because I don't, wow. I mean, because this isn't a film about COVID, because it's a film about at least 20,000 people in New Zealand who feel like the state is against them. And that's a quite stark reality. And I found it a bit difficult to get my head around, really, when I started to interact with them. But I felt like by the end, I kind of understood them. And you know, had some empathy for where that had come from. I mean, I don't agree with him, but I didn't pretend to. But I kind of get it, you know, and it isn't going away. It didn't die on the front lawn of Parliament a year ago, almost exactly. It's still just bubbling away, and it'll come back. And it would be a really good idea for the rest of New Zealand to give it some respect and give it some thought, because, you know, it's still thinking about us.
Have you ever thought about doing, I guess I'd call it the Louis C.K. model, although that name's a little bit, not supposed to mention those names any day, where he basically decided he'd just film his own stand-up specials, put them behind his own paywall, charge people $5 and come and get it. Is our market too small to make that a financially viable
option? I think option? In fact, that's the truth of it. But, yeah. I mean, you know, realistically, that's how I made Helen, exactly the same. We just did it. But, you know, our institutional models for the final step between the finished film and the actual audience just are so tiny.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, you perhaps could make it work if it was of international appeal. But because my particular focus is New Zealand audiences, at the moment there just isn't a way. Or at least if there is, I haven't figured
it out. It is interesting, though, because I'm thinking about that. You're saying you're following the followers. And those followers are in every country. You know, they're the QAnoners in the US, and they're the, you know, whoever, they're the conspiracy theorists. So the conspiracy theorists are everywhere.
But well, yeah, I actually think, you know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this is an international story, and it's quite an interesting one, because, you know, effectively it's more, well, somewhat it's MAGA, but happening in a country that doesn't really have the driving forces that are generally considered to have driven MAGA. And in fact, it's landing particularly with young Māori. You know, I mean, MAGA in the US is you know, relatively racist and you know, overall, and yet here it is landing with Māori. That's interesting and a bit weird and a bit unusual. And I do think that it casts an interesting light, not just on what's happening here, but actually on that whole movement about what it actually deeply is, which I feel still isn't very well understood by most people.
Dude, there's the pitch to Netflix.
In
America, yeah, I know. It's like, I can hear it. In America, why don't you want to see, how about you see this, indigenous people in country in South Pacific taking on MAGA virtues?
Yeah.
I'd watch that as well. And I wonder if many Americans would. But yeah. Are you the expert in this? Not me. I don't know.
I wish I was an expert. I mean, it's like there's some kind of weird magical incantation you have to say in order to crack through, but I don't know what it is. And I don't think anyone knows what it is. And at the moment, it isn't working for films that are for New Zealand culture. So we really need a solution to that. I have to say, I don't know how it would have happened, but I was hopeful that perhaps the public broadcaster at least was changed and maybe something could have shaken out. Now that's gone, I just don't know. I'm not even sure what to hope for, really.
I want to go into talk some specifics about, and I'm wondering if some of the questions I have would be answered if it was 90 minutes. Because like some of the things I'm going to be like, what happened next? You know, which aren't in the 22 minutes. And I wonder if they would be in the 90. But I want to ask some specific questions. I love having these conversations. I mean,
Can I just say, I mean, what this current film actually is, what we decided to do was to take quite a specific slice of the story and just make that. It's not like trying to squeeze down this 90-minute thing. I actually tried that. And it just doesn't work in that format. You know, it's too big a story. But, you know, I think what I found particularly interesting about Jamie Lee was the odd mystery of why a professional politician, as he puts it himself, would want to kind of nail themselves, you know, nail their colours to this mission, like what his agenda was. You know, he was painted as being very craven and very kind of, you know, like irresponsible.
Yeah,
I thought that was a reasonable allegation, but I was just interested to understand if that quite scanned personally with him and what it was, because at the end of the day, for movements which are quite extreme, like this one actually is, maybe more so than people realize, to make it into the mainstream, they need people like him willing to bring all of these conventional political skills and apply them to it. And New Zealand's actually full of people who are willing to do that for practically any cause. I find that interesting. You know, the kind of, you know, it's like nuclear scientists or nuclear weapons scientists. You know, they're so interested in whether they can that they perhaps don't think very often about whether they should. And Jamie Lee's quite, from his point of view, he's quite clear that his profession is sales, effectively. It's his job to take this kind of, you know, obviously impossible to sell thing and turn it into something that many more people will go, oh, maybe, you know. That's the whole story from his point of view. And he says it is no more of an ethical consideration than, you know, if your real estate agent was, you know, finding a way to spin your dodgy second bathroom when they were selling your house. He just sees it as that kind of problem.
As you started to say real estate agent, I was thinking if you had just said sell the house, I would have said sell the house, but know that the foundations were crumbling without trying to tell the buyer that the foundations are crumbling. And you covered it off as well. You talked about Duncan and the guys at Spinoff not thinking you'd be able to get access or questioning that. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you did that, and I wonder why Jamie Lee did this.
Well, I mean, he should answer that question, but I mean, it wasn't easy, to be honest. It took it wasn't even easy to get hold of him. I had an initial engagement with him, and then he sort of didn't answer the phone for a long time. Then I tried ringing him on a different phone, and he answered it by mistake, and we got talking and blah, blah, blah. And basically, he'd seen Campaign, which was a film that I made, you know, many moons ago back following the 1996 election.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone of his political generation's seen it. And I think they consider it a sort of foundation text, really. So that everyone thinks that I'm long dead. So that's funny. But he thought that Mark Thomas was unwise and that he'd be smarter than Mark Thomas. And I think that was part of the appeal. He thought he could handle me better. So he wanted that challenge. But, you know, I think, you know, to be more respectful to him and people in general, I think there is sincerely a desire for a lot of political people to create some sort of legacy or to sort of tell their story. You know, I mean, people might consider him to be doing something unethical, but I think, in my experience, most people that I've ever filmed that are doing anything that they're doing, they don't have a problem with it at the time, because if they did, they probably wouldn't be doing it. So, you know, he wasn't embarrassed.
Right.
And just struck him as a good idea. They kind of half hoped they were going to win, I think. And he thought it would be a sort of a triumphant story about that happening. I mean, could have been, I suppose.
I was talking to Simon Wilson in this podcast last week from New Zealand Herald. And I asked him about his political allegiances, because he is obviously he's a lefty and he puts it out there. And when he writes his you know, his op-eds. They're from that perspective. But he says, when I do news, it's straight down the middle, you know, like he can do both things. What about you? Do you have political allegiances that you talk about publicly? If they are, did Jamie know what they were? Do they align with his? And I'm not talking about the anti-vaxxer stuff. I'm just talking about like center left, left, middle, center. And if did that ever come into a point of like trust or distrust to get this thing as well? Like, do you align with the National Party and is that a way to get it? Do you align with the Labour Party? And that was a question that you had to overcome? Or are you just like, you're neutral everywhere because of what you do? You don't let on who you are politically.
No, I've never really subscribed to that theory. It strikes me as disingenuous and also a bit silly these days. I mean, who, you know, anyone control anyone's Facebook and work it out pretty quick. I don't have a party allegiance, and I think it would be, you know, that would be inappropriate. But I swing left generally in terms of my general sort of, you know, interests and outlook on things, and there's no secret, and anyone can find that out. But I actually don't see that as super relevant when I'm making films, because, I mean, my real interest is in what I can see. You know, my films don't have voiceovers, they don't have scripts. I'm not directing the action. I'm there to see what I can see. I think, you know, like for example, when I made Campaign, you know, I'm. The Mark, for example, our politics are pretty different, Mark's and mine, but we got on very well and I respected him and I still do. We're still mates. You know, there was a time when it wouldn't have seemed weird to think that you could disagree with someone but still be fair to them and still kind of, you know, want to tell their story in a fair way.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's how I see it. But maybe I'm naive. I don't know. But No.
Look, I'll tell you. I think you're not naive, and we experience it in both this podcast and I make six podcasts a week, so I do a lot of this stuff. And one of the other ones we do is like a daily news show, and we constantly are getting now. Oh yeah, but you're a lefty. And that seems to be by some people what they think is their kind of, well, your position is irrelevant. In other words, there was a time where if your argument was good enough, it didn't matter where you come from. But now, because of the tribalism that you talked about in 2019 when we talked, that people seem to use that in this day and age as a, well, I'm not going to listen to you because we don't align politically. That's what I was wondering, if there was any point of that comes into,
well, look, I mean, you know, I think documentary. One thing that has occurred, of course, is that there are now lefty films and right-wing films that are, you know, I mean, they're propaganda, basically, and I hate them. I mean, they're such a waste of time. I was watching a Jon Stewart thing the other day, and it was just awful. I mean, it doesn't interest me to kind of score points and have people clap like otters at it. I mean, I think that is so boring and so easy. I mean, I guess my primary connection really is probably to culture rather than politics, by which I mean, you know, the things that are the things that we agree on, even if we disagree on the specifics about politics, which is still most things, you know. And I think it's quite interesting to engage people in a discussion about how their behaviour or the things that they want to do in the world sit with what we are as New Zealanders. And most people are still willing to have that conversation, in my experience, and that's a more interesting conversation and a more important one at the end of the day, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, fascinating. Hey, a question about a decision you made for the documentary, and I'll mea culpa because I'm an idiot, Tony. is no voiceover on the documentary. I'll tell you, because I'm dyslexic as well, sometimes words don't quite jump around like they're supposed to. So I go in here and I look at the documentary and I read Elements of Truth behind the scenes of Jamie Lee Ross. And in my head, I'm going, oh, this is the behind the scenes. So they're going to show us a whole bunch of footage here of that. And when there was no voiceover, I actually watched the whole thing through once. And then I went, oh, hang on, this is the documentary. So then I watched it again and then again. And I just wondered from a technical storytelling point of view, I mean, lots of documentaries have actual voiceovers. Why no voiceover?
I hate voiceovers, and I think it's quite primitive. You know, it turns a lot of things into illustrated lectures.
Right.
I dislike it for two reasons, actually. One is because no matter how artful you are at writing it, I mean, you know, you can go the whole Herzog route and, you know, make it a kind of a aesthetic feature itself. But I don't see any need to tell the audience what things mean or what they should think about them. And so therefore, what the hell's left to say? You know, it's our job. We're skilled craftspeople. We can make it so that it can be understood without that. And so I just prefer not to have it. You know, when the very first documentaries were happening, you know, Nanook of the North, you know, they had the voiceover to explain everything that was going on. It's old and it's boring. I mean, you know, a proper cinematic filmmaking should not require it, in my personal opinion, and I practically never use it. So that's the wanky answer. The more practical answer is that in the absence of a voiceover, in my experience, audiences actually really lean in. Like, they know that there's kind of more space on the canvas. It becomes a bit more, sorry, I said this was the less wanky answer, but it's a little bit Brechtian in the sense that, like, it's like walking onto a darkened stage, you know, and there's not very much to look at. So therefore, the things that are there get a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And I find, like, if you really want people to read the nuance and to kind of enter into the tone of the moment, it's best to just leave it as spare as it can be and give them the space to do that. It's easy to just sit there watching something and just go, oh yeah, and you're just kind of like bobbing along like in like a river. I don't think that's worth bothering with any, you know, not for me anyway.
Yeah. And look, I have to say, as I said, I guess I've been accustomed to that, so it was what I was expecting. And then when I realized that's what it was, I agree with you. I was more drawn into it because I kind of watched it flippantly in the background to start off with, thinking that I was watching something that I wasn't. And then when I realized, I like looked at it again and I was like, oh yeah. And now what I'm doing is I'm going, now who's this and who's that, and you're not telling me, and I'm going to ask you some of those questions now. Who's this and who's that?
But, please do. Bug it up. No, that would be
it's not bug it up. It's like but I'm now more engaged with the content because I'm now wondering other things as well. So it's sparked me to think more about the story and to think more about, you know, the overall picture as well. So I'm on board.
I love it. And I should say, you know, I was really enormously assisted in achieving this time around by having Chris Pryor as editor for the film. Chris is an extraordinary observational documentary filmmaker himself, has made just this beautiful film called The Ground We Won, which if you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's the most astonishing. I mean, it's the type of film I'd like to make when I grow up. It's really, really beautiful and just so quietly meaningful, you know. I mean, you shouldn't need it, you know. I mean, we're not TV journalists, you know. We're filmmakers. It's different. Yep. And this is part of what that means from my point of view.
Hey, let's have a look at some stuff from the documentary. I'd really like to ask you a couple of questions specifically about it. Now, this is quite near the start of the documentary and a public meeting where Billy TK is and also Jamie Lee Ross turns up to. Real simple question. I mean, the guy who is basically at the front right now with the Australian accent
will be part of a people's movement.
This guy. Yeah. And the question.
I'm glad that a man like this stood up in New Zealand to be counted.
The reason this question is actually relating back to another question I want to talk to you later on about tax and about international money. Who is he? Because I was wondering about international influence in this actual, you know, the process as to what was going on with this Advance New Zealand Party. Is that just he happens to be a Kiwi guy who was from Australia, now lives here, or was there, you know, he's obviously Australian. Who was he and what was. Was there any part of Australian interest put into this campaign, and was he someone there who was helping it?
It is an interesting question, and it was something that I was quite struck by too as I was going along. I don't know all of the details of this particular person. He cropped up again on election night. He is, I understand, a property developer from Tauranga, obviously immigrated here from Australia. He said in the speech, we didn't have it in the film, but he said that he came here because he felt that Australia was kind of becoming a nanny state and New Zealand hadn't done it yet and he wanted to be here instead for that reason. I understand that he's quite involved in the churches, you know, the kind of the more modern kind of
evangelical, you know, movement.
Yeah. And you know, is a wealthy individual who, you know, I'm not certain, but I suspect he was probably somewhat involved in the financing of the party, and he was certainly involved in founding it. You know, he invited Billy TK to come and talk with a bunch of his influential friends and sort of was quite instrumental in creating a political movement out of what until that point had just been a sort of a Facebook, you know, sort of a thing. Obviously, elsewhere in the film, there's allusions to Chinese money as well. And that's you know, that was quite palpable, as indeed it is throughout New Zealand politics. It is interesting, international money in our political movements, and I think that we have somehow not quite engaged with just how serious that potentially is. Obviously, this was perhaps a bit unusual in that the particular Chinese money that was being attracted to the movement was associated with a anti-CCP kind of dissident, I think expat Chinese billionaire community who are interested in turning China into a democratic country at some future time, and by the looks of it, an ultra-capitalist democratic country. I mean, I don't know very much about them. I sort of saw them kind of around the place, but it was clear that they were of significance from a funding point of view and potentially from a political point of view in terms of votes and that they could engage in their own communities. And they certainly seem to be influencing Advanced New Zealand's tenor and politics by the end of the election campaign by that mechanism. Maybe people think that's cool, but I do think we need to have a discussion about that type of influence on our domestic politics, because it's got, you know, bottomless implications if it's allowed to just happen.
Interesting. All right, we are going to ask a bit more about international influence on Advanced New Zealand as we go through based on stuff. Mm-hmm. So the second question is, it's from the same meeting actually, and it's just a screenshot. You talk about the themes of Advanced New Zealand and the MAGA situation attacking being quite attractive to Māori. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me that anytime you saw a public meeting, other than the march, like let's be fair, on the march there were Māori involved there, it was not a particularly diverse audience. So I'm interested as to, because you've got Billy TK who's speaking at these things, who is Māori and who is pushing his agenda through his various social media outlets. But the audience that seems to come seems to be, no one would ever say 100%, but, you know, looking at any of the shots of the audience, not diverse at all. A lot of grey hair, a lot of kind of 40 years old and plus, and predominantly white. Is that what you experienced actually through the whole process?
No, not really. I mean, actually, okay. I think in the front row there, I think you probably got three women who may be Māori, but I think, you know, it's an interestingly diverse audience. There is a lot of conservative, often church-affiliated older Pākehā attracted to the movement. And I think that has actually a very interesting historical foundation, which I can tell you about if you're interested.
Sure.
Well, I mean, back when I was at university, there was the first United Nations Climate Summit. Do you remember that? And it was at the time when...
I'm far too young, Tony, to remember.
Yeah, no, of course you don't remember that. You're probably in utero at the time. But this was at the time when, you know, the Gaia theory was associated with that movement. And Gaia was this metaphor that the planet is this living organism and that, you know, we're trying to keep her alive. Sounds innocuous enough, but it doesn't if you're a Pentecostal Christian. They found that to be anti-Christian and became very suspicious and very alienated from the movement. The Agenda 2030 idea is actually originally a book by Glenn Beck, but it turned into an idea which Billy spoke about at every single meeting, including this one. And it basically says that at that meeting and subsequently, the United Nations and all of the world's leaders have met and decided that they are going to save Mother Earth, and they're going to do it by killing off a significant slice of their populations.
Right.
So all of the world's governments believe and have signed up to genocide on their internal populations. And at that moment is kind of underway, but also coming. They are therefore trying to alienate people from their guns and from their ability to grow their own food and all sorts of other things, so that it will in the end be easy to control them, round them up. And
then that leads into, and they're forcing us to stick things in our arms, and there is a huge number of people dying from that. And this is actually what's going on.
And like, I mean, if you believe, or even if you just kind of like sort of kind of find it plausible that the world's governments have this agenda, then obviously you'd be quite nervous about just about anything that pops up you know, and you can see from that point of view why the stuff that happened during COVID would be quite concerning, and you know, it was to a lot of people. I mean, You know, I think the really interesting thing for me was actually watching how people moved from being just kind of vaguely interested to being more radicalized in this movement, because it wasn't what I thought it would be. It's not like you take all these ideas, and there's lots of them, and try to, you know, every single one gets kind of individually argued into your head. It doesn't work like that at all. Basically, it comes down to convincing people that everything they know is politically motivated, and it's designed in order to get them to go along like sheep with this lie that actually they're in danger, and their families are in danger, and their communities are in danger, and that there's a conspiracy against them, and right. therefore, you know, they should be mature and sensible and hear it properly and understand that that their time is coming when they have to stand up. And I tell you what, you know, the funny thing is, well, sorry, not funny. The completely tragic thing is, if you stand on a Pai Pai, as I did with Billy TK in Northland, and listen to him saying this to particularly a group of young Māori, they don't find that particularly ridiculous. In fact, I think they actually find it historically resonant that the state might be planning on killing them and their families. And it's that's quite startling to some sort of like an urban liberal like myself. There truly are people who don't find that difficult to believe. And as soon as you do that, as soon as you kick the foundations out from under people, that you can't watch the news, they're in on it. You know, you can't listen to Ashley Bloomfield, he's in on it. Everyone's in on it. Then therefore, like everything, all your whole structure of belief is suddenly washed away, like Esk Valley. You know, it's all gone, and suddenly whatever you know the one person you can believe has to say, that'll do for now, and that becomes a structure of belief. I mean, it's not new. It's kind of, it's as old as time, I suppose, you know, this type of thing, but it's so fast, and it really takes advantage of a wiring kind of shortcut that I didn't actually really understand. So seeing that was interesting and quite startling.
You seem to spend your time with Jamie Lee Ross in this documentary, not with Billy TK one-on-one. So I don't know whether that was part of what happened, or if in the longer edit, the director's cut, there might be more of Billy TK.
So, you know, that's sitting there for a feature film one day.
So my question is, did Billy TK actually believe they were going to win? Did he actually believe that they were going to be in Parliament?
It was hard to tell. You know,
that was a long sigh. Tony, it was a long sigh, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, really, that was one of my questions too. I was just interested because a lot of people, I suppose, in my Wellington circle, perhaps thought he was a con man and that it was all a kind of some sort of scam.
Right.
I didn't get that impression I think he believed it, but I also felt that what he believed was quite fluid. I noticed on the campaign trail, because I was probably the only person other than him that actually went every night when he would talk to different audiences, and it changed. You know, it was quite dynamic. But it didn't, you know, what didn't change is the music, and that's kind of the nature of it. It's not really about these 27 beliefs. It's about this general sense of the way the world is, you know, this line. Sort of Wagnerian opera about how shitty and dark the world is and how we have to stick together as a whānau around this warm fire of our belief in order to be safe. I don't mean this in a religious sense, although that was wound up in it too, but fundamentally this is a politics based on a belief rather than logical kind of deductive reasoning. I actually think most politics is like that in truth, but this movement in particular is like that. People they felt that nothing they knew was safe to believe anymore, and that they were therefore grasping on to what was around to try to understand what the hell was going on. And as well, a lot of the people who believed had really traumatic experiences at the hand of the state, either directly or, you know, in their community, and they were predisposed to believe that shit is dark and nasty, and that's not surprising, and, you know, and to be expected. I found that I could go around at the meetings and point the camera at someone and say to them, "When did this start for you?" And that was a weird question, but they all understood it, and the stories that they told were extraordinary. You know, one of their candidates, for example, was an addiction nurse, a very senior, you know, postgraduate qualified addiction nurse who watched her young adolescent drug addicts dying on a waiting list. And it just totally broke her heart until finally she realized it wasn't just the universe and the state and general bureaucratic bullshit. It was part of the plan. This was it happening. This was these people being killed off. And she, as she says that to me, she smiled, you know, because that's such a, it's a better thing to believe for a lot of people, that there is actually a bad guy or a bunch of bad guys rather than just a cold and different universe.
In the documentary, there's a moment where Jamie Lee Ross is rewording something, rewording advertising, and he talks about Billy wording. I'm wondering why Billy wording, and for people who haven't seen the documentary yet, things written by Billy, Billy wording causes difficulty. I think that's a phrase that Jamie Ross uses.
Because, as I mentioned, Billy's politics and views and the things he said changed all the time and often were way, way more radical than what Jamie Lee had signed up for in their coalition negotiations, as he called them. It was an interesting thing, actually, that Jamie Lee said that I think is worth considering. He said, you know, in any political party, there's a range of beliefs, and no one person believes all of it, but they all have to sell all of it. And so, therefore, the politicians can only be reasonably expected to believe a certain proportion of what they say. You know, he also drew a distinction between, you know, you can bend the truth without making it untruthful. He you know, politician language, he called that.
Yep.
And you know, we hate politicians for doing that. But on the other hand, I kind of think perhaps we need to look at ourselves and say, aren't we making that necessary? I mean, is it really their fault that they're doing the thing that works because we like it at the time?
And also because they can't get trapped, like if a politician says, I won't do this. Like, I hate this thing about taxes won't go up. I hate all those kind of promises because think, well, if in the future, let's say there is, I don't know, a massive flood which requires taxes to go up and they've made some pledge before the election. Imagine, like, just hypothetically speaking here, Tony. And they've made a pledge, no income tax or no tax rises in our first term, yet there's an event which actually the resulting that potentially taxes going up would be useful to, then they're stuck into this thing. So they use this kind of mealy-mouthed roundabout wording so they never get trapped in anything concrete, and because if they do, then if they have to go against it for the right reasons, then they're screwed. I think we require that, because what happens is the media and the public go, but you said, and you're like, yeah, but I said that based on not knowing about this event, which is causing us to need to change, but we won't accept that. We just go back to, but you said.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, there's a New Zealanders need to actually have a serious think. If we want politicians to be honest, if we really want that, what would it sound like? You know? It wouldn't sound like someone who could sort of be in office for 5 years and be saying the exact same things at the end as they were at the start. That doesn't make sense, you know?
Yeah.
They would have to come on and go, yeah, I did say that, but I was wrong, and I've learned some things since then because I've been Prime Minister for a while, and here's what we're doing instead now, because this is now necessary, you know? And we probably would crucify them for it, to be frank. I don't think we actually do want that from our politicians, or if we do, we don't reward them for it. Yeah. So therefore, that's not what we get, and that's sort of our fault, really.
Yeah. No. I'm
not saying that to defend Jamie Lee, right? I mean, he's got to live with himself, but he makes a very interesting point about what professional politics actually is, and whether that's, you know, who owns the responsibility for that, really.
Who sets the rules? I mean, do we set the rules because we've grown to expect that, or do they set the rules and we've adhered to it as a chicken and egg? I don't know, but those are the rules right now, is what you're kind of saying.
I think media is a significant part of it, because that kind of, you know, oh, but you said thing is like, it's a real easy, superficial, but simple way of kind of, you know, making your bones as a journalist, I guess, you know, trapping some politician into... I mean, I think what a politician would have to do in order to escape from that horrible thing is just be willing to say, yeah, I did say that, and now it's different, and that's how it is. Punish me if you like, but I'm changing my policy on that because I was wrong, and now this is what needs to happen. Or even, well, I mean, I was right, but circumstances have changed.
I think that's the thing. It's like, if if the best thing to do is go against something that you said a year ago, because a year ago you didn't know about it, it's actually not I was wrong, as you said. It's like at that point, we could say that things have changed. Like it's like saying I'm never going to leave this house. I'm going to live here the rest of my life, and your house burns down.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Yeah. I'm going to stay in the ashes because I said I would. Yeah. So I'm going to stay. You know, like actually, circumstances have changed. Therefore, the pledge I made needs to change. But Tony, we're far too balanced and sensible for politics, obviously, because that's not
obviously,
how
it works. Of course. I think so.
I want to ask you a specific question about techs. Because for people who haven't seen it yet, and I'm sure most people have by now, there was a guy called Tex who was going to donate $30,000 to the campaign. And this is a short 40-second conversation between Jamie Lee Ross and Tex. Let's have a listen to this.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Or do you want to split up to the
No, that is illegal. That can't happen. The other thing I need to run past you, Tex, is... can you tell me, please, is the money coming from a New Zealand citizen or resident, or is it coming from you personally?
I need to work this out, but we'll definitely be complying with sort of these. Like, it'll be probably a resident, permanent resident, if not a New Zealand citizen. So, and source of fund, that's all good, because I mean, money's all legal and local, so. Just, you know, found the best way to do this.
I mean, that's all I'm doing. I just wanted to play the pause at the end that Jamie Ross is like, it's again the international thing is a part of this because A, it's a South African accent. B, obviously there's concern about.
I don't think it is a South African accent. I think it's a Chinese accent.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So Chinese accent. I sounded South African to me, but then again, I'm a moron. I was wondering who Tex
was. I say that because I met Tex. I should say I assume the same Tex. I don't know that for certain. He was associated with the Chinese pro-democracy movement that was, as I mentioned, pretty loomed quite large in advanced New Zealand during the time that I was with them.
Right.
So he was connected to that in some way. He worked as a studio producer for a music recording session that Billy TK did in a recording studio that they seemed to own and make available to Advanced New Zealand. So there's a lot of money involved, you know, a lot of money. I don't know its source. I was told it was pro-democracy Chinese billionaires. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's obviously...
Can you explain to people what's that code for? Pro-democracy Chinese billionaires. Is that code for something else?
It may well mean pro-democracy Chinese billionaires. I could be. I don't know. There is a backgrounder on Tex that the spin-off have written based on some research beyond the film. So people who are interested in finding out more about him could go and have a look at that. Mm-hmm. There is an active protest movement who a lot of New Zealanders will have seen out protesting, who are Chinese expats who are keen on an anti-CCP platform and changing the political system in China. That may be precisely what it looks like. It interests me as well that other, for example, international security services would perhaps have an interest in supporting that too. So exactly where the money comes from and exactly what it's all about, I don't know, but it's quite a lot of money. And I suspect it's landing variously in New Zealand politics. And I think that awkward phone call that Jamie Lee is having, which, by the way, he dealt with very correctly, right? This was after the things that he was subsequently found not guilty for in court, but prior to the actual court case. So, you know, he was sensitive, obviously. This is a daily reality for New Zealand politicians. They really have to have significant amounts of money coming from somewhere, and a lot of it is coming from fairly vague and difficult to pin down sources, which is really ought to be a great concern to New Zealanders, in my opinion.
That phone call didn't make it clear whether they ended up taking Tex's donation or not, because it cuts quite quickly to a conversation with the New Zealand Herald about running a full-page ad. Did they take that money in the end, you know?
I don't know. I went and had a look, and it doesn't appear, obviously, in their record of returns. So not in the form that was where it had to be reported. I put it that way. Okay. And
that's an interesting way to word it. I was also going to say, from that conversation, we come up to Jamie Lee Ross's name being accountable under the Electoral Act. And I'm assuming what that means is he's sort of the name to be used on the Electoral Act for Advance New Zealand.
So I think he's the party secretary, which makes him legally liable for it. Yeah.
Is that because he was a politician that he got access to that, or could anyone be that person? It just happened to be him and for Advance New Zealand.
I think under legislation, it's specific to the party secretary. And in his case, he was the party secretary because he started Advance New Zealand, and Billy TK came later and merged his existing party, New Zealand Public Party, with Advance New Zealand.
Cool. Let's move on, because I want to talk a bit about documentary shows Jamie Lee Ross watching some of the Paula Penfold interview with Billy TK, which was devastating. I actually did a podcast with Paula about conversation as well, because this is what I do, Tony. We like to talk about these things. It shows a little bit of interaction and what Jamie was thinking about it, but not a lot. Can you expand any on what Jamie Lee Ross thought of that Paula Penfold interview and how he responded to it, other than what we saw maybe in the doco?
He was initially pretty startled that it was as long and as
45 minutes,
crushing, really, as it was. He was actually surprisingly laid back about it in terms of its immediate political impact, or if he wasn't, he was doing a good job at not letting on about that to anyone, including me. I think he probably sort of was aware to some extent of the things that Paula's story talked about. I would guess, and it's only a guess, that he felt that the close party members wouldn't believe it anyway and would see it as a politically motivated smear, and so therefore it wouldn't particularly matter so much with the close party. He probably did, though, see in it a pretty big whack to his goal, which was to bring people from sort of adjacent places into the tent, because obviously it was not great from a Billy TK branding point of view.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, either wasn't that fussed about it or knew that it wouldn't make that big of a difference amongst the voting faithful. I hear what you're hearing.
Yeah, it would be an exaggeration to say he wasn't that fussed about it. He knew it was bad, but it wasn't the only bad thing that was happening at the time. I mean, you remember there was news stories about one of their candidates said that beams from space had started the Ohau fires, and there was a lot of that happening. And the media really rounded on Advance New Zealand in the end and clobbered them pretty comprehensively. For better or worse, I mean, I have mixed feelings about it, but that happened a lot in the last couple of weeks.
I've got one more little clip to play you that I want an expansion on. Mostly, really, this podcast is just about me finding out information that I want to know about your documentary, Tony.
Have a podcast to talk about it? That's sweet, no problem.
I don't know if you can recognize it before I play it, but this little clip here is about Jamie Lee Ross leaving National and how he felt about it.
At certain points, it was life and death.
We don't talk about those bits in front of the kids.
At certain points, it was life and death, but we don't talk about that in front of the kids. Did you ever get an expansion on that? What is he talking about walking away from National being life and death?
As he does say in the film a bit later, he ended up in psychiatric care. He was on suicide watch. He was he meant exactly what he said. It was nearly life and death for him.
His reference point in that conversation was what it did to him, not like some nefarious, otherworldly, under. Okay, so it's that bit there. He's specifically meaning for me. It drove me to a point of being life or death.
Yeah.
Understood.
And he speaks later on about how the way that he was sort of managed and sort of massaged out was the same manipulative tactics that he'd been responsible for doing as the senior National Party whip a year earlier to other MPs.
Yeah.
And, it's a pretty sad ass insight into what it's like being inside a major political party. He calls it the cult, where you have to do precisely what you're told on the weekly conference call, and that's all you're allowed to do. There's no space to for anything else, really, and it'll be punished. And it certainly was in his case.
Ironically, he calls it a cult while he's talking to Billy DK, whose followers are basically show every signs of being cult members, which I don't know whether he actually had the nous to show that. And what I'm talking about is just the religious aspect of what his.
Can I challenge you on that?
Please, let me, look, I
understand what you mean when you say that. And, a lot of the beliefs in that movement were pretty wild by the standards of kind of, a lot of New Zealanders. But. You know what? I mean, these guys were citizens of New Zealand. They were participating in democracy. I think a lot of people were really angry at them for believing stuff that a lot of others of us might have considered stupid. But at the end of the day, they really did. And there were times when they were pushed, I think, too hard towards kind of like the exit chute from democracy. And they felt that, and I can tell you, it's sitting very clear in my wider footage, the fact that they could feel themselves being marginalized and sneered at and disrespected was a really significant part of more deeply radicalizing them. Everyone kept saying, Billy kept on saying, if I wasn't speaking the truth, why are people reacting with this aggression towards us? It doesn't make sense if I'm just making things up. And people, it's pretty credible. A lot of people in that audience at that big rally in Aotea said to me, I don't like bullies and he's being bullied. I think that's sort of fair, not of everything that was said, but there were definitely places and times when they were not treated with the respect that maybe it would have been smarter to treat them with. Because, in the end, we bloody really seriously need everyone in New Zealand to be in the tent when it comes to democracy.
Agreed.
What the hell happens if they're not? I mean, what are they supposed to do next? I mean, they're going to shut up and disappear. Okay, but they're not. They're just going to pursue what they consider to be essential, community interest outside of democracy. And that never ends well. And it's not smart for us to do.
Look, I think what you're saying is fair, but I will push back a little bit because I've spent a lot of time researching and investigating cults. It was sort of a bit of a habit and a passion of mine back in the day. And what you're describing is David Koresh from Waco, Texas. The members of his church, like the words you're using about why would they be worried if we were just talking bullshit, all these sorts of things, those sorts of words were the words he used as well. Now, I'm not blaming, this is the difference, right? I'm not actually blaming the cult members for being pulled into that. So that's maybe a difference that I'll make clear, but it doesn't mean that they're not in a cult. And I'm not suggesting that Billy TK is as dangerous or as far gone as David Koresh was, but all of those sorts of same descriptors of him as a leader, they could be, there's parallels between the two of them.
I understand what you're saying, Pat, but just let me push back in this specific way. I didn't end well with David Koresh, did it? It wasn't handled well by the power that was trying to deal with him. And there's an analogy there as well, you know, with what ended up happening on the front lawn of Parliament. And we should have learned from that, right?
Mm, yeah, but very true.
In particular, we really should have learned that no matter what people believe, if they are New Zealanders and if they're on the public stage and if they're trying to engage in with the rest of us, just sort of flitting them away, refusing to have them at meet the candidate meetings, all that kind of thing, that's pretty dumb, in my opinion. I mean, the other thing is it others them. Saying they're members of a cult is a really good way of othering them. And I think that that's happened a lot. And it's happened by a lot of lefties, frankly, like me and you perhaps, who would be the first to condemn anyone else for othering someone, right? But they've been kind of put in this box. And I think that's one of the reasons why people were so mad at them, because one of the unfortunate side effects of Jacinda's we should be kind to each other moral scheme was that if people aren't doing the thing that the kindness is attached to, then obviously they're unkind. They're not pro-social, they're not pro-community. And I think there was a lot of anger directed at these people for not being responsible for the rest of us. All I want to say about that is that my direct observation of hundreds of people in this movement is that they were not antisocial people. Most of them were deeply community people. Most of them were involved in churches, marae, early childhood. I mean, like all sorts of things where they're very, very engaged and they're connectors too. That's why so many turned up to Parliament. They're not kind of living in the basement lunatics. And it's a very dangerous idea to think that they were and that they still are. That's not who it is. And that's not what it means. And,
I think it's ironic. I think it's ironic in this conversation because both of us are saying, I'm going to push back. But I actually think we're saying something very similar because I actually agree with everything.
Yeah, totally.
I think, and like I've said, because I've done 220 broadcasts of a news show over the last 12 months. And every single time talking about, you know, people who have been misinformed around things like vaccines, my response has always been, I feel sorry for them because they've got the wrong information. They're not bad people necessarily. They've got the wrong information. However, in saying all of that, if, like you're saying, at meet the candidate evenings, we do all of us choose to draw a line somewhere. Like, we're not going to allow someone to come to a meet the candidates meeting who is going to stand up the front and preach, my word, literal hatred, dangerous information. Oh, by the way, we're the this is how teenagers commit suicide party, and I want to put all our policies out there. You know, we wouldn't allow, we are all going to draw a line somewhere. And I think what I'm getting, what I'm feeling is that we have different places where we would draw lines in society as to when that person should or shouldn't be included in. And let me just restate one thing about the cult comment. I think what I said, and if I didn't, I'll say it now. What I see in some of the followers of those things is cult-type tendencies or cult-type behaviors. Because what I hear from their leaders is the way things are worded are very much like cult-type leaders. Now, whether that softens it a bit, because look, I know lots of these people. You know, I had a barbecue with lots of these people just the other day, and we're perfectly amicable and friends with some of them. It's not a problem, but that doesn't mean that the behaviors you see aren't also seen in other areas, like in some cult type areas. Does that make any difference to what we're saying now?
Well, Jamie Lee Ross saw behaviours he thought were like that in the National Party, and I actually think there's a pretty pretty good argument that most politics is like that. That's kind of, you know, it's another way of describing the tribal thing that we started off with, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, most of us flatter ourselves, and I think it is complete bullshit. We flatter ourselves that we believe the things we believe because we've looked into them. You know, we know what policy should be. We know what fiscal policy should be. We know how the Reserve Bank Act works. We don't know shit. I mean, hardly any of us could, from first principles, explain why we believe any of the things that we do should happen politically. Most of it is an argument from authority. Somebody that we think is believable has told us that's a good idea. Yep. And we've gone, okay, then, you know, yeah. And then that's what these guys are doing as well. And, you know, we may think, oh, yeah, but we're right and they're wrong. They think we're wrong. I mean, it doesn't mean there is no truth. I mean, let me be clear about this. I'm not a postmodernist. I don't think that, you know, somebody's fantasy is as good as my reality. I do not, right? But I also think that if somebody turns up with a completely different view, then it's kind of, you know, it's my job to actually to be able to show why I'm right. They might not believe it, but hopefully the audience does and the world's better. It's not absolute. Look, I'm not a complete free speech fanatic. I think if somebody's turning up and wanting to pull democracy apart, then that's the line, right? You know, so like fascists, for example, I mean, that's relatively straightforward. But short of that, I think the smart thing to do is to give reasonable respect and reasonable engagement and allow people to work it through and have confidence that because they are fundamentally good people, that they'll mostly get there, you know, get somewhere, follow up something that's true.
We are in an accord. Like I've said for a very long time, I wouldn't call myself a free speech purist, but in the opportunity to lean towards more or less, I always lean towards more. Like I said, I wouldn't have someone on my podcast who advocated for this is how women should be circumcised. Like I wouldn't, that's not speech I'm going to support. But there is a line, and I'm certainly way down the free speech end. So I think we are actually talking in a very similar way, maybe approaching different.
One of the reasons I really wanted to make this film in the first place was I didn't actually understand who the hell they were. I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. And that at least should happen, I think. You know, before we adopt fixed positions and draw fixed lines, we should actually engage enough to at least make sure that our assumptions are right. because a lot of mine weren't, and I think that's probably true for a lot of us. It would be a better idea to keep talking at least for a while and get to grips with it.
Yeah. No, I agree. Hey, it seemed there was a great amount of concern on the night of the election to tell Billy TK that they weren't going to win. Why was that?
Well, as Jamie Lee said on the night, because Billy will have faith, and he did. And by his own admission, Billy wasn't a politician. He didn't really get it. And like actually all politicians, campaign was exactly the same. Every politician I've ever spent time with on the election trial is exactly the same. Everyone they talk to thinks they're awesome. So they think, oh, there's a groundswell. Yeah. Everybody loves me.
Echo chambers.
And they just, you know, it's always a real bucket of water in the face. But in his case especially, I mean, you know, I think he, I don't know what in his heart of hearts he thought, but it was pretty devastating, bit of a slap in the face. And and I think in particular, Jamie Lee thought that Billy had felt that he'd been constrained a little bit, that Jamie Lee had been kind of making him compromise in order to be electable. And right. Because he hadn't been electable, therefore he'd been sort of betrayed or let down, or the promise hadn't been met. And as the film reveals, and I found it quite amazing, actually, they never spoke again after election night, still to this day. It was a pretty tight relationship on, you know, apparently they called each other brother, but man, so there was a huge sense of, I think, perhaps something like betrayal on Billy TK's part that Jamie Lee hadn't delivered the goods.
That Tova interview, and I remember seeing that, I was like, holy crap.
Yeah, it was huge. Worldwide, it was enormous.
And I loved that we got to see in your documentary the behind the scenes, like your camera being behind the cameras and her turning up and him saying, you're going to be kind to me. And she said, what did she say? No, I'm going to be mean or something like that. Now, I don't know how much tongue in cheek that was, but, you know, is it Macbeth? Jesters oft prove prophets. As we often say, many a truth be told in jest. I don't know if she was mean, but she was hard and accurate. We don't need to go.
I talked to her the other day. She said she was grumpy that day. So I mean, I've also heard her say before that she, you know, she was just doing a job and she didn't really understand what all the fuss was about. I mean, it's funny. I stood at the back of that studio. I had no idea what to expect. I was only let in at the last minute, obviously, when they decided what it was going to be like. And it was, I had an oddly kind of two-toned reaction to it. Like on the one hand, I didn't think it was unfair. I mean, it was fair. Yeah. And it was actually delivered reasonably, you know, it wasn't nasty, I didn't think. I mean, there's a few moments, maybe a bit, but like it was more or less down the middle. But on the other hand, what an absolute kicking, you know? And I felt sorry for J-Mo, maybe not exactly, I don't know. It's like watching a public execution, you know? You might think they're guilty, but it doesn't mean you want to see them have their head cut off in front of you.
You saw him have his head cut off in front of you, and then you saw the carcass afterwards because you were still with him, and that's what I wanted to know. We saw him walk out, and in the video, he's like, oh, I like Tova. She's strong. It's like, then, I don't know, did you guys get in the car together?
Yeah, interesting.
What do you feel like the authentic response was from Jamie Lee after that, if there was one?
I felt in the lift. He didn't exactly say it. He said what you said. He said that he liked her because, you know, she said, says what she believes. And there was this look in his eyes. For me, it's the most important moment in the film. There's this kind of, it feels like you can suddenly see his soul, which is that he kind of knows that he's locked into this world where he can't say what he believes or doesn't think he can. And so therefore he feels a certain longing towards her agency to do that, I think. But you know, you see in the film, very soon afterwards, you know, he's out in a cafe and he's sort of bouncy-ish again.
Until another cafe customer turns up, he's sort of bouncy until that.
I mean, he I think he perhaps hadn't fully understood that he wouldn't be understood. He thought that people would understand that he was a professional politician just doing his work and, you know, doing his best. And actually, he'd reeled in a lot of Billy TK's more, you know, far out there things. So therefore, I think he saw himself as doing some sort of public service. And I think he honestly did think that most people would sort of understand that, especially insiders like Tova and me. You know, we'd forgive him and we'd all kind of, you know, be all members of the club still. It was becoming clear that wasn't happening and that must be hard for him.
Well, speaking of that, do you have any contact with either Billy TK or him? Do you know what they're doing for 2023?
I haven't talked to Billy for quite a long time, but Jamie Lee actually rang me up on the morning the film premiered, and we had quite a long conversation. He's out of politics and seems to be quite enjoying it. He says that he can't quite believe how important everything felt then. It doesn't seem important anymore, you know?
Yeah.
He's kind of involved in various businesses and stuff. I think from his point of view, it's all over. And I think clearly it's not viable for him to be back in politics again.
And he doesn't want to be?
Part of him does, I think. You know, at the end of the day, it's his profession. He's been a professional at it since he was 18 years old. And it's what he's best at. And, you know, I don't think he thinks it's all that fair or all that kind of rational what's happened to him or how he's been vilified. But yeah, it sounds like he's kind of realized that that's not a retrievable situation.
Right. Hey, we've probably been a bit longer than I said I would, but I do want to ask you one other little kind of series of questions, which won't take long. It's looking towards 2023. You're obviously a bit of a political animal. You've been involved around politics in the last election, at least. What do you see coming up this year? And I'm also interested in about this year about, I mean, the lockdowns and we didn't have vaccines, but that world was sort of a culture war issue of 2020. Do you observe what's going to be 2023's culture war issues? Is it going to be Three Waters? And what's going to happen to the advanced New Zealand parties this time around, like the Freedom and Outdoors group, the people who are still kind of carrying that same bucket? What do you see upcoming for 2023 and now in our election?
Well, you know, on the front lawn of Parliament a year ago, there was an extraordinary jockeying for position for a whole bunch of various little political movements attempting to kind of engage that audience in this or that, ranging from Freedom and Outdoors, which is an interesting group, across New Conservatives, you know, some fairly full-on white nationalism, just all kinds of stuff was kind of boiling away. I don't know. I mean, you know, the obvious candidates would probably be co-governance more than anything, it strikes me. And I guess you could say that's Three Waters, but actually it's a lot bigger than that. And the kind of the future of Māori engagement with actual public service and government is an exploitably controversial issue and hasn't been explained well. I wish it would be public broadcasting, but it totally won't. That's
kind of view. Just pause for a sec because I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Because the thing about co-governance and MAGA seem opposing, incongruent. So why would young Māori, I don't want this to turn into an hour-long answer for you or for me, but because it could. But why would one side of co-governance, which is sort of, you know, abiding by treaty agreements, giving Māori sort of some power in the system, putting them in a place to be involved, then not be taken on board? Because on the other hand, the MAGA is like getting them away, literally killing them, moving them on. How do those two things, because they seem to be opposing, why would young Māori be drawn to one and not the other? Or are they drawn to both depending on the day?
Well, I mean, there's no politics like Māori politics. They're intense, like internal Māori politics. And, you know, I really can't speak to it with any authority, but my observation is that in the same way that a lot of younger Māori are quite alienated from the state and politics at a national level, they're also quite alienated from tribal politics. And so there's kind of a feeling that, you know, the tribal grandees might, you know, sort of sell them out to government and you know, do this and that and go on their fat cat trips to Wellington and all that, but what does it do for us kind of thing? Yeah. So, you know, there's a degree of cynicism about that, selling out. There's also, you know, in the far north where Billy lives and is most active, there's Hei Whakaputanga is a huge cultural force, which was new to me, which predates the treaty and is kind of based on a different philosophy where, kind of like we're all one people, you know, we don't need to be separate. So I'm simplifying that grossly, but, you know, a sense of everyone being welcomed into the same waka, which has a different sort of structural response, I suppose. So it's complicated. It's even complicated within Māoridom. And in terms of outside it, The dominant message, actually, from New Zealand MAGA, it's not a very good label for it, but, you know, this movement is distrust of the state, distrust of institutions. Right. So building new ones or different ones is probably not an improvement. You know, it's very communitarian and based on a sort of a 50s idea that we're all going to just be one big happy family, coffee-coloured, you know, and I'm simplifying, but, you know, like that everyone can be part of something more local.
Do you have any predictions for the upcoming election? Do you get that deep into it, looking what's going to happen?
It's going to be close, I reckon, as everybody keeps saying. Right at the moment, it's feeling like National kind of assumed that the standard playbook would get them there, and I kind of don't think it's going to work. So either they have a reimagination the ball of that.
Yeah,
and do something like more radical quickly, or I don't know, maybe Labour will sneak in. To be honest, I mean, Labour back in, perhaps with a Green coalition, they'll be third term, and they'll be sort of, you know, they could go real hard, but perhaps they'll be fairly limp in that, you know, lame duck kind of mode. I don't know, really. It's a hell of a lolly scramble. I can't remember an election like this.
I think the idea of being limp is quite a good wording for Labour. Obviously, COVID and the response to it has been a big part of the season, but they haven't really done anything substantial, really. I mean, it's a little bit like if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything. And I wonder if them with the Greens would be quite a shift. And I would wonder if a government got in for a third term, they'll go, well, we're definitely not getting a fourth, because that just doesn't happen. So we better get it all done now. Yeah, but look,
You know what the problem is, that I can tell you from Wellington, the whole town is buckling down for a complete rot financially. Like that there's going to be just a massive, just a clean out of the public service just because of the money that COVID and now the cyclone is going to cost to fix. Right. So the ability to resource and actually achieve radical change it's definitely swimming against that tide, and that might be the answer right there, I suspect.
All right. Hey, Tony Sartorius, Unreal Films. The documentary is called Elements of Truth. Head to Spinoff if you want to find it. And here's a conversation with you between you and Toby Manheyer, I believe. But there it is right there. Yeah. Elements of Truth, if you want to see the documentary for yourself. And what kind of fat cat do we have to get on board to get the 90-minute documentary made? How much money do you need? We'll just put it out there. Get a Patreon started. You'll be sorted.
Maybe we should. Look, I mean, you know what? There's no point making it if there's no way to get it to an audience. That's the real problem. So, I mean, this is a political problem more than it's anything. And I'd really invite people to take that seriously. Ask the question on the campaign trail at Meet the Candidate meetings and stuff. This is a big issue, you know, and it hasn't been talked about much yet. But in the meantime, you know, I'd really appreciate it if they like the film, they could share it to their friends. That's the only way people are going to find out about it. So, you know, that would be really helpful.
Amazing, Tony. Always is. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Pat. It's been a pleasure.